was a Washington, D.C. financial institution that had been acquired for BCCI by former Secretary of Defense W. Clark Clifford. The cash came from the Gambino crime family, which was shelling out $50 million for each shipment. Blocked by national security. The laundering at First American was conducted in conjunction with Worthern Bank, a financial institution owned by Jackson Stevens, and the Arkansas Development Finance Authority, a state agency that had been set up by Governor Bill Clinton. Stevens had been a major donor to Clinton's 1982 gubernatorial campaign, and Worthern had provided the candidate with a $3.5 million line of credit. The BCCI's front in the D.C. bank was Kamal Adam, who, according to the Kerry Committee report, operated as the CIA's principal liaison for the entire Middle East from the mid-1960s through 1979. In his attempt to probe First American, CBS correspondent Bill Plant complained, "There is a trail of tens of millions of dollars in cocaine profits from MENA, Arkansas, and we don't know where it leads. It is a trail blocked by the National Security Council." During Ronald Reagan's term in the Oval Office, the Great Jihad in Afghanistan grew in scope and strength, threatening to sap the USSR of its strength and resolve. The inhabitants of the five republics of the Soviet Union, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, who shared a common Turkish heritage and remained devoutly Islamic, became supportive of the Mujahideen in the struggle against their communist overlords. This support, combined with the massive amount of Muslim recruits to the Great Jihad from the Arab world, served to create a creeping sense of futility among the Soviet troops. To drive the evil empire to the point of total collapse, the CIA continued to infuse the holy war with munitions and money until the war in Afghanistan became the agency's most expensive covert undertaking. By 1985, the Afghan rebels were receiving $250 million a year in dirty money from the CIA to battle the 115,000 Soviet troops occupying the country. This figure was double the number of Soviet troops in 1984. The annual payments to the Muslim guerrillas reached nearly $1 billion by 1988. By this time, the CIA was also shipping highly sophisticated weaponry, including Stinger missiles, to the jihadists, whom they mistakenly viewed as freedom fighters. Muslim missionaries. In an effort to support recruits to the jihad, the CIA once again focused its attention on America's black community. This development was understandable. The agency realized that millions of African Americans, who felt disenfranchised by the system, had converted to Islam, which they saw as the black man's religion. This movement, prompted by such black leaders as Timothy Drew, Noble Drew Ali, Elijah Poole, Elijah Muhammad, and Malcolm Little, Malcolm X, had given rise to hundreds of mosques within America's inner cities. By 1980, the CIA began to send hundreds of militant Muslim missionaries, all members of the radical Tablighi Jamaat, to the U.S. mosques in order to call upon young black men to take up arms in the holy war to liberate their Muslim brothers. Sheikh Mubarak Gilani, one of the first of these missionaries to arrive, convinced scores of members of the Yasin Mosque in Brooklyn to head off to guerrilla training camps in Pakistan with an offer of thousands in cash and the promise of 70 huris in seventh heaven if they were killed in action. The cash came from the CIA's coffers. The training camps. Realizing that it would be financially advantageous to train the new recruits on American soil, Sheikh Gilani, with the help of the CIA, set up paramilitary training camps in rural areas throughout the country, including Hancock, New York, Red House, Virginia, Commerce, Georgia, York, South Carolina, Dover, Tennessee, Buena Vista, Colorado, Macon, Georgia, Squaw Valley, California, Marion, Alabama, and Tallahena, Oklahoma. By 1985, the international press began to report that an unspecified number of African-American Muslims, all related to ul-Fukra, had joined the ranks of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and that several had been killed in action. When questioned, several of the jihadis imported from America would testify that they were agents of the CIA. The Al-Qaeda cell. To provide more support for the Mujahideen, the CIA used Abdullah Azzam, Osama bin Laden's mentor, to set up a cell of Al-Qaeda within Masjid al-Farouk on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. The cell, known as the Al-Kifa Refugee Center, acted as a front for the transference of funds, weapons, and recruits to Afghanistan. Throughout the 1980s, this militant organization received over $2 million a year, and Masjid al-Farouk became a very wealthy institution. During this time, Azzam spent a great deal of time in Brooklyn. In a 1988 videotape, he can be seen and heard telling a large crowd of African Americans that blood and martyrdom are the only way to create a Muslim society. By 1992, Al-Farouk Mosque had become a haven for Arabian veterans from the Great Jihad in Afghanistan, who were granted special passports to enter the United States by the CIA. A feud erupted between the older African-American members of the mosque and the Arab newcomers, which resulted in the murder of Mustafa Shalabi, the fiery imam of the mosque, on March 1, 1991. The crime has never been solved. New CIA amigos. The soaring expenses for the covert war in Afghanistan, coupled with the ongoing need of support for the guerrilla units in Latin America and the secret armies in Western Europe, caused the CIA to forge new alliances. In 1980, the agency deployed Dewey Claridge, its top agent in Latin America, to establish ties with Honduran drug lord Juan Mata Ballesteros, who operated Setco, an airline that was used for smuggling drugs into the United States. In accordance with the working relationship, Setco transported narcotics to gangs and gringos north of the border and arms to a warehouse in Honduras that was operated by CIA operatives Oliver North and Richard Secord. The weapons were purchased by the agency's cut of the deal, which in one transaction amounted to $14 million. Business arrangements were made with other drug lords, including Miguel Ángel Félix Gallardo, the godfather of the Mexican drug business, whose ranch became a training ground for right-wing guerrilla armies, and Miguel Nassar Haro, the leader of the Guadalajara cartel, Mexico's most powerful narcotics network. By 1990, more than 75% of all the cocaine entering the United States came through Mexico. Mexico also became a leading source of heroin, marijuana, and methamphetamines. The business was generating $50 billion a year, and the CIA had found a source of funding to augment its ongoing heroin trade with the Babas and the Sicilian Mafia. The new alliance meant that the agency could launch hundreds of new operations even more ambitious than Gladio. As Americans were becoming increasingly drugged, they were becoming increasingly impoverished, since the plans of the international bankers had given rise to unlimited free trade and the globalization of poverty. 35. The Globalization of Poverty. Since the 1980s, a large share of the labor force in the United States has been driven out of high-pay unionized jobs into low-pay minimum-wage jobs. Poverty in America's ghettos is, in many respects, comparable to that of the Third World. While the recorded rate of unemployment in the U.S. declined in the 1990s, the number of people on low-wage part-time jobs has spiraled. With further declines in minimum-wage employment, large sectors of the working population are pushed out of the labor force altogether. In turn, economic restructuring has created profound divisions between social classes and ethnic groups. The environment of major metropolitan areas is marked by social apartheid. The urban landscape is compartmentalized along social and ethnic lines. Michel Chosudovsky, The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order. Henry Kissinger was a product of the House of Rockefeller. He graduated from Harvard in 1950 as a Rockefeller Foundation Fellow in Political Science. In 1956, he was invited by the Rockefellers to join the Council on Foreign Relations, where he became a major force in shaping international policy. Explaining Kissinger's rise in the CFR, J. Robert Moskin, author of the U.S. Marine Corps story, writes, "It was principally because of his long association with the Rockefellers that Henry Kissinger became a force in the Council. The New York Times called him the Council's most influential member, and a Council insider says that his influence is direct and enormous, much of it through the Rockefeller connection." During the 1960s, Kissinger served as Nelson Rockefeller's chief foreign affairs advisor and the mastermind behind Nelson's campaign for the presidency. The relationship between the two men was so close that Kissinger dedicated his memoir, The White House Years, to Nelson, describing him as the single most influential person in my life. Waking the Sleeping Giant. When Richard Nixon became president, he appointed Kissinger as Secretary of State, in accordance with the advice of the Rockefeller family. In this position, Kissinger tirelessly advanced the agenda of the money cartel, including the promulgation of free trade between all nations. This agenda prompted him in July of 1971 to visit China, where he negotiated a trade agreement by which the communist country would receive most favored nation status with the United States, a status that would permit Chinese goods to flow into America free of charge. Kissinger was accompanied by Winston Lord, a member of the National Security Council staff, who later became president of the CFR. By the time Nixon visited China the following year, the terms of the deal had been set in stone. The treaty, which was ratified by Congress, caused David Rockefeller to gloat, "The Chinese are not only purposeful and intelligent, but they also have a large pool of cheap labor, so they should be able to find ways to get trading capital." Of course, the Chinese found ways of getting trading capital. However, the funds did not come from their own resources, but rather from the IMF World Bank, which proceeded to supply the communist country with billions of tax-free loans. Goodbye, Made in America. Manufacturing plants sprouted up throughout China. The products and goods were produced in these plants by workers making less per month than union workers in America were making per hour. Women working in the Timberland Shoe Company in Guangdong Province labored 14 hours a day at 22 cents per hour. At a factory making Kathy Lee Gifford handbags for Walmart, the highest wages were $7 a week. Compounding the problem for American manufacturers was China's manipulation of its currency. By 2010, China had devalued the yuan by 45%, cutting in half the cheap labor for companies moving to China, and doubling the price of U.S. goods entering the communist country. The trade deficit stood at $266 billion. Throughout America, factories began to relocate to Southeast Asia, and an ever-increasing number of American workers found themselves on the unemployment line. A list of the companies that moved their manufacturing facilities to China is as follows. AT&T, Abercrombie & Fitch, Abbott Laboratories, Acer Electronics, Ademco Security, Adidas, ADI Security, AGI, American Gem Institute, AIG Financial, AgriLink Foods, Inc., Profac, Allergan Laboratories, American Eagle Outfitters, American Standard, American Tourister, Ames Tools, Amphenol Corporation, Amway Corporation, Analog Devices, Inc., Apple Computer, Armani, Armor Meats, Ashland Chemical, Ashley Furniture, Associated Grocers, Audi Motors, AudioVox, AutoZone, Inc., Avon, Banana Republic, Bausch & Lomb, Inc., Baxter International, Bed Bath & Beyond, Belkin Electronics, Best Buy, Best Foods, Big Five Sporting Goods, Black & Decker, Body Shop, Borden Foods, Briggs & Stratton, Calrad Electric, Campbell's Soup, Canon Electronics, Carol Cable, Casio Instrument, Caterpillar Inc., CBC America, CCTV Outlet, Checker Auto, Citicorp, Cisco Systems, Chiquita Brands International, Claire's Boutique, Cobra Electronics, Kobe Electronics, Coca-Cola Foods, Colgate-Palmolive, Colorado Spectrum, Conagra Foods, Cooper Tire, Corning Inc., Coleman Sporting Goods, Compaq, Crabtree and Evelyn, Cracker Barrel Stores, Craftsman Tools, C. Sears, Cummins Inc., Dannon Foods, Dell Computer, Del Monte Foods, DeWalt Tools, DHL, Dial Corporation, Diebold Inc., Dillard's Inc., Dodge Phelps, Dole Foods, Dollar Tree Stores Inc., Dow Corning, Eastman Kodak, EchoStar, Eclipse CCTV, Edge Electronics Group, Electric Vehicles USA Inc., Eli Lilly Company, Emerson Electric, Enfamil Estee Lauder, Eveready, Family Dollar Stores, FedEx, Fisher Scientific, Ford Motors, Fossil, Frito-Lay, Furniture Brands International, Gap Stores, Gateway Computer, GE General Electric, General Foods International, General Mills, General Motors, Gentech, Gerber Foods, Gillette Company, Goodrich Company, Goodyear Tire, Google, Gucci, Guess, Häagen-Dazs, Harley-Davidson, Hasbro Company, Heinz Foods, Hershey Foods, Hitachi, Hoffmann La Roche, Holtz Automotive Products, Hormel Foods, Home Depot, Honda Motor, Hoover Vacuum, HP Computer, Honda, Honeywell, Hubble Inc., Huggies, Hunt's Wesson Foods, Icon Office Solutions, IBM, IKEA, Intel Corporation, J.C. Penney, J.M. Smucker Company, John Deere, Johnson Control, Johnson & Johnson, Johnstone Supply, JVC Electronics, KB Home, Keebler Foods, Kenwood Audio, KFC Kentucky Fried Chicken, Kimberly Clark, Knorr Foods, Kmart, Kohler, Kohl's Corporation, Kraft Foods, Craig & Auto, Land's End, Lee Kum Kee Foods, Lexmark, LG Electronics, Lipton Foods, L.L. Bean Inc., Logitech, Libby's Foods, Linens and Things, Lipo Chemicals Inc., Lowe's Hardware, Lucent Technologies, Lufkin, Mars Candy, Martha Stewart Products, Mattel McCormick Foods, McDonald's, McKesson Corporation, Magellan GPS, Memorex, Merck & Company, Michael's Stores, Mitsubishi Electronics, Mitsubishi Motors, Mobil Oil, Molex, Motorola, Mott's Applesauce, Multifoods Corporation, Nabisco Foods, National Semiconductor, Nescafe, Nestle's Foods, Nextar, Nike, Nikon, Nivea Cosmetics, Nokia Electronics, Northrop Grumman Corporation, New Skin International, Nutrilite, NVIDIA Corporation, GeForce, Office Depot, Olin Corporation, Old Navy, Olympus Electronics, Orion Knight Electronics, Pacific Sunwear, Inc., Pampers, Panasonic, Pan Pacific Electronics, Panavice, Papa John's, Payless Shoe Source, Pelco, Pentax Optics, Pep Boys, PepsiCo International, PetSmart, Petco, Pfizer Inc., Philips Electronics, Philip Morris Companies, Pier 1 Imports, Pierre Cardin, Pillsbury Company, Pioneer Electronics, Pitney Bowes Inc., P. Pizza Hut, Plantronics, Play School Toys, Polaris Industries, Polaroid, Polo, see Ralph Lauren, Post Cereals, Price Pfister, Pringles, Praxair, Procter & Gamble, PSS World Medical, Pile Audio, Qualcomm, Quest One, Radio Shack, Ralph Lauren, RCA, Reebok International, Reynolds Aluminum, Revlon, Rome & Haas Company, Samsonite, Samsung, Sanyo, Shell Oil, Schwinn Bike, Sears Craftsman, 7-Eleven, Sharp Electronics, Sherwin-Williams, Shure Electronics, Sony, Speco Technologies Pro Video, Shopko Stores, Skechers Footwear, Smart Home, Smuckers, see J.M. Smuckers, Solar Power, Inc., Spencer Gifts, Stanley Tools, Staples, Starbucks Corporation, Steelcase, Inc., STP Oil, Sunkist Growers, Sunmade Raisins, Sunglass Hut, Sunkist, Subway Sandwiches, Switchcraft Electronics, Cisco Foods, Sylvania Electric, 3M, Taipan Trading Company, Tamron Optics, Target, TDK, Tektronix Inc., Texas Instruments, Timex, Timken Bearing, TNT, Tommy Hilfiger, Toro, Toshiba, Tower Automotive, Toyota, Toys R Us Inc., Trader Joe's, Triplite, True Value Hardware, Tupperware, Tyson Foods, Uniden Electronics, UPS, Valspar Corporation, Victoria's Secret, Vizio Electronics, Volkswagen, VTech, Walgreen Company, Walt Disney Company, Walmart, WD-40 Corporation, Weller Electric Company, Western Digital, Westinghouse Electric, Weyerhaeuser Company, Whirlpool Corporation, Wilson Sporting Goods, Wrigley, W.W. Granger Inc., Wyeth Laboratories, X10, Exelite, Xerox, Yahoo, Yamaha, Yoplait Foods, Yum Brands, Zale Corporation. Protectionism forsaken. The economic situation in America worsened as more countries, including India and Pakistan, received most favored status. By 2010, 50,000 manufacturing plants in America had shut down. Almost everything that Americans purchased came from overseas manufacturers. Shoes, clothes, cars, furniture, TVs, appliances, bicycles, toys, cameras, and computers. The goods flowed into the country free of charge, violating the principles of America's founding fathers. Alexander Hamilton had written, "The superiority antecedently enjoyed by nations who have preoccupied and perfected a branch of industry constitutes a more formidable obstacle than either of those which have been mentioned to the introduction of the same branch into a country in which it did not before exist. To maintain between the recent establishments of one country and the long-matured establishments of another country a competition upon equal terms, both as to quality and price, is, in most cases, impracticable. The disparity in the one, or in the other, or in both, must necessarily be so considerable as to forbid a successful rivalship without the extraordinary aid and protection of government." Cheap foreign labor and tax-free imports also impacted the defense industry. In 2010, Senator Fritz Hollings wrote, "Today, the United States has less manufacturing jobs than in April 1941. Long before the recession, South Carolina had lost its textile industry, North Carolina its furniture industry, Michigan its automobile industry. The defense industry has been offshored. We had to wait months to get flat panel displays from Japan before we launched Desert Storm. Boeing can't build a fighter plane except for the parts from India. Sikorsky can't build a helicopter except for the tail motor from Turkey. Under law, the Secretary of Commerce lists those items vital to our national security, but Congress fails to make sure we can produce these items for our defense. Today, we can't go to war except for the favor of a foreign country. The World Trade Organization. On January 1, 1995, the World Trade Organization, WTO, came into being with headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland. It was set up to integrate nations into a world order without tariffs or other economic barriers. The principal beneficiaries were the 80,000 transnational corporations, which account for two-thirds of the world trade. A 2014 New Science study showed that 1,318 core transnational corporations, through interlocking boards of directors, owned 80% of global revenues, and 147 of them formed a super entity that controlled 40% of the wealth of the entire network. Not surprisingly, this super entity was dominated by the business interests of the House of Rockefeller. The WTO represented one of the final steps in the creation of a new world order. It was empowered under international law to police the economic and social policies of its 164 member states, thereby derogating the sovereign rights of national governments. Under WTO rules, noted economist Michel Chosudovsky writes, the banks and multinational corporations, MNCs, can legitimately manipulate market forces to their advantage, leading to the outright recolonization of national economies. The NAFTA nightmare. Just when it seemed that the situation for American workers could not get worse, the North American Free Trade Agreement came into force on January 1, 1994. The agreement was developed by the Council on the Americas, an organization set up by David Rockefeller in 1965. The Rio Grande now separated two distinct labor markets, as production facilities closed in the United States and Canada and moved to Mexico, where wages were 10 times lower. Thanks to this agreement, the United States suffered an additional trade deficit of $181 billion and the loss of 1 million more jobs. NAFTA also resulted in the displacement of more than 1 million Mexican campesino, who packed up their belongings and headed off for El Norte, the USA. A nation of takers. From December 2000 through December 2010, America lost 3 million private sector jobs, the worst record since 1928 to 1938, and 5.5 million manufacturing jobs. One out of every three Americans who worked in a plant or factory was out of work. In 1950, manufacturing constituted 27% of the U.S. economy. 40 years later, that number dropped to 11%. By 2011, 22.5 million Americans worked for the government, while only 11.5 million worked in manufacturing. This was a reversal of the situation in 1960, when 15 million worked in manufacturing, while 7 million collected a paycheck from the government. Commenting on this situation, Stephen Moore wrote the following in a piece for the Wall Street Journal. More Americans work for the government than work in construction, farming, fishing, forestry, manufacturing, mining, and utilities combined. We have moved decisively from a nation of makers to a nation of takers. Part 10. America No More. Jefferson Memorial, Washington, D.C. inscription under the dome. I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Jefferson to Dr. Benjamin Rush, September 23, 1800. Panel 1. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. We solemnly publish and declare that these colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. The Declaration of Independence. Panel 2. Almighty God hath created the mind free. All attempts to influence it by temporal punishments or burthens are a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion. No man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship or ministry, or shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief, but all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion. I know but one code of morality for men, whether acting singly or collectively. Well aware that the opinions and belief of men depend not on their own will, but follow involuntarily the evidence proposed to their minds, that Almighty God hath created the mind free, and manifested his supreme will, that free it shall remain, by making it altogether insusceptible of restraint, that all attempts to influence it by temporal punishments or burthens, or by civil incapacitations, tend only to beget habits of hypocrisy and meanness, and are a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion. A Bill for Establishing Religious Freedom, Section 1. 36. The Road to 9/11. The excessive accumulation of money wealth from the proceeds of the drug trade has transformed the CIA into a powerful financial entity. The latter cooperates through a web of corporate shells, banks, and financial institutions wielding tremendous power and influence. These CIA-sponsored corporations have, over time, been meshed into the mainstay of the business and corporate establishment, not only in weapons production and the oil business, but also in banking and financial services, real estate, etc. In turn, billions of narco dollars are channeled, with the support of the CIA, into spheres of legitimate banking where they are used to finance bona fide investments in a variety of economic activities. Michel Chusadovsky, America's War on Terrorism. Heroin, by the turn of the 21st century, had become one of the world's most valuable resources, a resource that could generate over $100 billion a year in revenue. Without the white powder, there would be no black ops, no means of obtaining control of Eurasia, no way of molding the global economy and political relations. On January 27, 2000, a catastrophe occurred for covert activity, when Mullah Omar and the leaders of the Taliban announced their plans to ban poppy production within the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. This decision sent shockwaves through the U.S. intelligence community. Afghan opium poppy harvest had grown nearly tenfold from 250 to 2,000 tons during the covert war of the 1980s, and from 2,000 to 4,600 tons during the civil war of the 1990s. The country's economy transformed from a diverse agricultural system based on herding, orchards, and 62 varieties of field crops into the world's first opium monocrop. Thanks to the Taliban ban, the opium poppy harvest fell from 4,600 tons in 1999 to 81 tons in 2001. The situation had to be addressed by the military-industrial complex in a forceful way. The ban not only brought the CIA's operations to a screeching halt, but also caused a mass exodus of poppy farmers from the fertile fields of the Helmand Valley. All the young people have gone to Pakistan, a farmer named Rashid told reporters. 90% of this area used to be cultivated with poppy. How much money can you make from wheat? Losing the crop was bad enough, but losing the farmers was devastating. The ban also spelled disaster for the international banking and business community, since heroin had become the third biggest global commodity in cash terms after oil and the arms trade. Michelle Chosadovsky explains.
Supported by powerful interests, heroin is a multi-billion dollar business which requires a steady and secure commodity flow. But the Taliban prohibition caused the beginning of a heroin shortage in Europe by the end of 2001, as acknowledged by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. One of the hidden objectives of the war on terrorism was effectively to restore the CIA-sponsored drug trade to its historical level and exert direct control over the drug routes. Immediately following the October 2001 invasion, opium markets were restored. Opium prices spiraled. By 2002, the domestic price of opium in Afghanistan was almost 10 times higher than in 2000. At the height of the opium trade during the Taliban regime, roughly 70% of the global supply of heroin originated in Afghanistan. In the wake of the U.S.-led invasion, Afghanistan accounts for more than 85% of the global heroin market.
The planned pipeline. Heroin was one cause of the war on terrorism. Oil was another. The situation in Afghanistan had become worrisome to the House of Rockefeller, which had been instrumental in bringing the Taliban to power in 1996. Through the Union Oil Company of California, UNICAL, the Rockefellers had arranged to provide the group with weapons and military instructors. This aid had enabled the Taliban to capture Kabul and to oust Afghan President Burhanuddin Rabbani from office. The UNICAL gifts of arms and advisors were given with the belief that the Taliban would provide assistance in the creation of a massive oil pipeline that would run from the oil wells of Turkmenistan through the mountains of Afghanistan to the port city of Karachi, Pakistan, on the Arabian Sea. It was a project that could not take place without a dominant central regime in place to suppress the country's tribal warlords. The 1,040-mile-long pipeline would have a shipping capacity of 1 million barrels of oil per day and would resolve the vexing problem of seizing control of the vast wealth of oil and natural gas that surrounded the landlocked Caspian Sea. The Grand Chessboard. UNICAL also planned through its subsidiary CentGas to build another pipeline, this one for natural gas that would follow the same route through Afghanistan. In the great game of geoeconomics, the two pipelines represented the integral parts of the plan to gain control of the Stan countries, as Zbigniew Brzezinski had set forth as follows.
The Grand Chessboard. The world's energy consumption is bound to vastly increase over the next 2 or 3 decades. Estimates by the U.S. Department of Energy anticipate that world demand will rise by more than 50% between 1993 and 2015, with the most significant increase in consumption occurring in the Far East. The momentum of Asia's economic development is already generating massive pressures for the exploration and exploitation of new sources of energy, and the Central Asian region and the Caspian Sea basin are known to contain reserves of natural gas and oil that dwarf those of Kuwait, the Gulf of Mexico, or the North Sea.
Raising the stakes. The Soviet Union had discovered the vast Caspian Sea oil fields in the late 1970s and attempted to take control of Afghanistan to build a massive north-south pipeline system to allow the Soviets to send their oil directly through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Indian Ocean seaport. The result was the decades-long Soviet-Afghan War. The Russians then attempted to control the flow of oil and gas through its monopoly on the pipelines in the former Soviet republics that surrounded the Caspian Sea, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and Azerbaijan. The leaders of these countries saw through this Russian monopolistic ploy and began to consult with Western oil executives, including Condoleezza Rice of Chevron, the predecessor of Rockefeller-owned Standard Oil of California. Ms. Rice, a prominent CFR member, later became President George W. Bush's national security advisor. The shadow government, under the direction of Standard Oil and the House of Rockefeller, now planned to thrust further along the 40th parallel from the Balkans through these Southern Asia republics of the former Soviet Union. The U.S. military has already set up a permanent operations base in Uzbekistan. This so-called anti-terrorist strategy was designed to consolidate control over Middle Eastern and South Asian oil and contain and neutralize the former Soviet Union. Realizing its weaker position vis-à-vis the United States, Russia joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, which included China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. Its membership in the SCO represented Russia's attempt to maintain its traditional hegemony in Central Asia. Thus, the stakes in the chess game became sky-high, since the winner gained global economic hegemony. The Taliban in Texas. Once they conquered Kabul, the leaders of the Taliban were whisked off in a U.S. military transport to Houston, Texas, where they were wined and dined by UNICAL officials, who had hired Henry Kissinger and Richard Armitage, who would become George W. Bush's Deputy Secretary of State, as consultants. Concerning the gatherings, L.A. reporter Jim Croghan wrote,
UNICAL's top executive, Barry Lane, says he wasn't involved in the Texas meetings and doesn't know whether then-Governor George W. Bush, an ex-oil man, ever had any involvement. UNICAL's Texas spokesperson for Central Asia Operations, Teresa Covington, said the consortium delivered three basic messages to the Afghan groups. We gave them the details on the proposed pipelines. We also talked to them about the project's benefits, such as the transit fees that would be paid, she says. And we reinforced our position that the project could not move forward until they stabilized their country and obtained political recognition from the U.S. and the international community. Covington says the Taliban were not surprised by that demand. In December 1997, UNICAL arranged a high-level meeting in Washington, D.C. for the Taliban with Clinton's Undersecretary of State for South Asia, Carl Inderforth. The Taliban delegation included Acting Minister for Mines and Industry, Ahmad Jan, Acting Minister for Culture and Information, Amir Mutaki, Acting Minister for Planning, Din Muhammad, and Abdul Hakim Mujahid, their permanent UN delegate. 2 months later, UNICAL Vice President for International Relations, John Maresca, testified before a House Committee on International Relations about the need for multiple pipeline routes in Central Asia. Maresca briefed the members about the proposed Afghan pipeline projects, praising their economic benefits and asking for U.S. support in negotiating an Afghan settlement.
Despite such power players, a final agreement was not reached because the Taliban was being pursued by other oil interests, including representatives from SCO. Meanwhile, the tentative U.S. ties to the Taliban was offset by Moscow's support for the Northern Alliance, the group of Islamic militants who ruled northern Afghanistan. Pressure was applied to Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, to come to a decision regarding the UNICAL offer. But no commitment from the chieftain was forthcoming, and the situation was becoming increasingly untenable. The embassy bombings. By 1998, the American power elite realized they had to set up a more cooperative government in Kabul. Plans were made to launch a terror attack against America that could be blamed on bin Laden and the host of Islamic militants that inhabited Afghanistan, including the Taliban. On August 7th, the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed. The attack killed 234 people, 12 of them American, and wounded 5,000 more. The event sent shockwaves throughout the United States. On August 20th, President Bill Clinton responded by launching a cruise missile attack on al-Qaeda's alleged residential and military complexes in Khost, Afghanistan, and the bombing of the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical plant near Khartoum in the Sudan, where bin Laden once lived. The CIA had informed Clinton that these attacks would catch the al-Qaeda leaders unaware, since no member of the Mujahideen would believe that the United States was capable of such decisive action. The agency further affirmed that the Al-Shifa plant was producing deadly VX nerve gas. Bill Clinton Bilge. Following the attack, Clinton addressed his fellow countrymen from the Oval Office by saying,
"Our mission was clear, to strike at the network of radical groups affiliated with and funded by Osama bin Laden, perhaps the preeminent organizer and financier of international terrorism in the world today. Earlier today, the United States carried out simultaneous strikes against terrorist facilities and infrastructures in Afghanistan. It contained key elements of bin Laden's network and infrastructure and has served as the training camp for literally thousands of terrorists around the globe. We have reason to believe that a gathering of key terrorist leaders was to take place there today, thus underscoring the urgency of our actions. Our forces also attacked a factory in Sudan associated with the bin Laden network. The factory was involved in the production of materials for chemical weapons."
The Clinton announcement was of vital importance to the shadow government. It identified Osama bin Laden as mankind's greatest enemy and the Taliban as a group that served him. The announcement also informed the American public that new attacks were in the works and that weapons of mass destruction were in production to be used against them. The problem was that none of it was true. Bin Laden and his Muslim pals were not in the coast camp. They were, as the CIA was well aware, safe and sound within a madrasa in Pakistan. Although the missiles struck the camps, the only casualties were local farmers and some low-level militants, and the Sudan pharmaceutical plant was not involved in making nerve gas or any other chemical weapon. It produced common over-the-counter drugs, including ibuprofen. A false flag operation. What's more, information surfaced that the attack on the embassies was not conducted by Al-Qaeda, but rather a false flag operation that could be blamed on bin Laden. A key indicator of this contention was the involvement of Ali A. Mohammed, also known as Ali the American, in the bombing. Following the attack, he was labeled as the point man who had masterminded the operation. 2 years after the blasts, Mohammed was arrested by the American authorities and pleaded guilty to conspiracy to murder. It then came to light that the alleged Al-Qaeda bomber had an impeccable U.S. military service record. He had been trained at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and worked as an instructor in explosives at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School until 1989. The official government narrative claimed that Mohammed, who was married to an American citizen and who had lived in California, was all the while working as a double agent for Al-Qaeda, and that he had become a bloodthirsty jihadi by the time of the embassy attacks in 1998. This narrative was circulated by the American media. One story in the San Francisco Chronicle in 2001 conveyed the sense of treachery as follows. Bin Laden's man in Silicon Valley, Mohammed the American, orchestrated terrorist attacks while living a quiet suburban life in Santa Clara. In reality, throughout the 1990s, Mohammed was working for the American Secret Services in East Africa, including Kenya. Vanished into thin air.
There is no way that U.S. intelligence handlers did not know of every move made by Mohammed.
Ralph Schoenman, a reporter who has spent decades investigating the 1998 bombings, maintains.
This guy was recruited by the CIA in Cairo, where he was a major in the Egyptian army. He was then a hand-picked graduate of Fort Bragg for American Special Forces, and he went on to instruct Green Berets in PSYOPs and explosives at the JFK School of Warfare. We are talking about the strictest security clearance in the U.S. military, and yet the official account expects the public to believe that somehow Mohammed's connections with bin Laden's Al-Qaeda slipped their attention, and that he carried out the U.S. embassy bombings in a rogue fashion for the supposed enemy.
Supporting Schoenman's contention is the fact that despite pleading guilty in a New York court in 2000 to conspiracy to murder American citizens, Mohammed has never been sentenced to confinement. There are no records of subsequent court proceedings, and his whereabouts to this day remain unknown. His California wife, Linda Sanchez, was quoted in 2006 as saying of her husband, "He can't talk to anybody. Nobody can get to him. They have Ali pretty secret. It's like he just kind of vanished into thin air." Dream fulfilled. In August 1998, the dream of Cecil Rhodes came to fruition with the merger of Amoco and BP, resulting in the formation of the world's largest oil company. The House of Rockefeller was now united with the House of Rothschild, and the two nations became inextricably bound both economically and politically. Billions of dollars now flowed into joint military-industrial interest, and such defense contractors as Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, Boeing, and Raytheon. Britain's new Labour government under Prime Minister Tony Blair now became America's unconditional ally. The two countries, in accordance with William Stead's foresight, would act in tandem during the war on terrorism, with America as the dominant partner. The movers and shakers behind the Anglo-American establishment, in keeping with Rhodes's vision, would meet in secret at the annual meetings of the Bank on International Settlements and the Bilderberg Conference. They also would gather within the inner sanctum of the Trilateral Commission, an outgrowth of the Council on Foreign Relations that had been established by David Rockefeller in 1973. This organization, by providing loans to foreign governments, including General Augusto Pinochet in Chile, made a cadre of American and British bankers more powerful than the elected representatives of both governments. After the merger of the oil giants, the primary concern of the new power elite was the need to build the Trans-Afghan pipeline and the threat to the world economy posed by the Taliban's ban on poppy production. They realized during their clandestine meetings that these problems could only be resolved by the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and the removal of the Taliban from power. Three steps toward endless war. The first step toward meeting these objectives had been the bombing of the two African embassies, which resulted in making the Taliban synonymous with Al-Qaeda, even though the two groups were sharply at odds. In 1998, Mullah Omar rejected bin Laden's repeated calls for violence against Americans and rejected the Al-Qaeda chieftain's religious rulings as null and void. Moreover, the scruffy Taliban leader resented the arrogance of the Arab Mujahideen, whose aristocratic attitude toward Pashtun customs and beliefs had become intolerable. Tensions between the two Islamic militant groups became so tense that gunfire broke out between the Taliban soldiers and bin Laden's bodyguards. In June 1998, the Taliban struck a deal with Saudi officials to send bin Laden to a Saudi prison in exchange for Saudi support and U.S. recognition of its legitimacy in ruling the country. Prince Turki bin Faisal, head of the Saudi General Intelligence Agency, confided to the Clinton administration that the exchange was a done deal. But after the missile attacks, Prince Faisal returned to Afghanistan to find the one-eyed Taliban mullah a changed man.
"Mullah Omar became very heated," the prince said. "In a loud voice, he denounced all our efforts and praised bin Laden as a worthy and legitimate scholar of Islam."
The second step toward legitimizing an invasion of Afghanistan was the appointment of Hamid Karzai as the head of the interim government in Kabul. Prior to this appointment, Karzai had acted as consultant and lobbyist for UNIKAL in its negotiations with the Taliban and as a CIA covert operator who had funneled U.S. aid to Mullah Omar and his band of radical Muslim students. The third and final step was the creation of an incident of enormous proportion that would warrant the planned invasion. That incident came on September 11th, 2001, when Islamic terrorists hijacked four American airliners. Two crashed into New York's World Trade Center, one into the Pentagon in Arlington County, Virginia, and the fourth in a field near a reclaimed coal strip mine near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. It resulted in the deaths of 2,292 Americans, public and private property destruction in excess of $21 billion, and the loss of more than 200,000 jobs. A war without end had started. 37. The Mysteries of 9/11.
On September 11th, 2001, the three worst structural failures in modern history took place when World Trade Center buildings 1, 2, and 7 suffered complete and rapid destruction. In the aftermath of the tragedy, most members of the architecture and engineering community, as well as the general public, assumed that the building's destruction had occurred as a result of the airplane impacts and fires. This view was reinforced by subsequent federal investigations, culminating in FEMA's 2002 Building Performance Study and in the 2005 and 2008 reports by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. Since 9/11, however, independent researchers around the world have assembled a large body of evidence that overwhelmingly refutes the notion that airplane impacts and fires caused the destruction of the Twin Towers and WTC-7. This body of evidence, most of which FEMA and NIST omitted from their reports, instead supports the troubling conclusion that all three skyscrapers were destroyed in a process known as controlled demolition, where explosives and other devices are used to bring down a building.
Architects and engineers for 9/11 truth. No one can doubt that two jetliners crashed into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, or that another jetliner flew into the Pentagon, and a fourth fell from the sky near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, on September 11, 2001. But everything else about that fateful day remains shrouded in mystery. Mystery number one, the pyrotechnic substance. The first mystery concerns the collapse of the Twin Towers, which represents the worst structural failure in modern history. The official story from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, an agency of the U.S. Department of Commerce, is that the impact of the jetliners produced fires that weakened the structure of the two skyscrapers, resulting in a gravitational collapse. But the evidence supports another story, one that concerns a controlled demolition. Such evidence includes 1. The rapid onset of destruction. 2. The constant acceleration at or near free fall of the collapsed floors through parts of the building that should have been paths of greatest resistance. 3. Eyewitness accounts, including those of 118 members of the New York Fire Department, of explosions. 4. Lateral ejections of multi-ton steel framing flying distances of 600 feet at 60 miles per hour. 5. The mid-air pulverization of 90,000 tons of concrete and large volumes of expanding volcanic-like dust clouds. 6. Isolated explosive ejections 20 to 60 stories below the crush zone. 7. Total destruction of the buildings with 220 floors. 8. Several tons of molten steel, iron among the debris, and evidence of thermite incendiaries on the steel beams. The final item is particularly telling. Neither jet fuel nor office fires can reach temperatures sufficient to melt steel, 2,750 degrees Fahrenheit, much less to bring steel to a boiling point. Thermite is a mixture of iron oxide and elemental aluminum that, when ignited, reaches temperatures between 4,000 to 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit and produces aluminum oxide and molten iron in a volcanic-like display. The presence of this substance among the ruins of 9/11 provided a telltale sign that the collapse of the towers may have been the result of a controlled implosion. Mystery number two. The stand-down order. The U.S. military had spent billions developing stealth aircraft, invisible to radar, that could intercept any air attack on the homeland. But on the morning of September 11, 2001, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, was oblivious that four jetliners were invading prohibited airspace and headed for central targets, including the Pentagon. Even after the first jetliner crashed into North Tower at 8:46 a.m., NORAD proved incapable of locating and stopping the second jetliner from crashing into the South Tower